Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 15 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we were joined by Albert from the Long Ball Football Podcast for an in-depth look at the ever-evolving landscape of Portuguese football. Elsewhere, we unpacked Bologna's validated patience and we considered the main takeaways from the recent Copa del Rey semi-finals. We looked at all of that and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. Welcome, dear listener, to another episode of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. We'll hear from Rory Barlow and Michael Jones in due course, but in the meantime, I'm delighted to be joined by a good friend of the show, Albert, from the excellent Long Ball Football Podcast, to look at some of the most intriguing storylines in Portuguese football right now. Albert, it's great to have you on again. How are you doing?
It's an absolute pleasure to be on the podcast again. Thank you so much for the invite. I will happily forgive you for it being a year since we last spoke about Portuguese football. Everyone knows that, you know, this is really the only league worth talking about. I'm happy that you've come back round to it. So, yeah, good stuff. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, likewise. And yeah, glad to hear that you're doing well. Yeah, we do probably have to beg for forgiveness for neglecting Portuguese football to an extent. It's a fantastic league. And actually, listeners of the podcast will know that I do enjoy a good nosy at Google Maps and football stadiums on Google Maps, and some of the quirkier stadiums lower down the table in Portuguese football are, yeah, really quite interesting to look at on Google Maps, particularly if you couple that with looking at the stadiums that were used in Euro 2004 and looking at what they look like now. But anyway, I'm digressing to an extent there, Albert. Yeah, that's probably how I'm going to spend the rest of my Sunday afternoon after we finish recording. But looking, I suppose, at more important matters than Google Maps, looking at the title race, at the time of recording, just 2 points separate Benfica in first place and Sporting in second place, with Sporting having a game in hand over their City rivals. Now, Roger Schmidt's Benfica are, of course, habitual winners and the reigning champions, but Ruben Amorim's Sporting look well positioned to kick on and secure their second title in the space of 4 seasons. So, Albert, where will the title race be won and lost over the final 10 games or so of the campaign?
Well, firstly, I think Sporting fans won't thank you for saying they're well-placed to kick on for the title. I know Portuguese football fans are very superstitious, so I won't go that far myself, but it's a very interesting title race. And in Portugal, one of the biggest ways that the league title is decided, is won or lost, as you say, is on big games between big clubs, because there's such a disparity between the sort of top three or four teams in Portugal and the rest of the league that, you know, these games when big clubs play each other, they come around sort of few and far between. But that's a real opportunity to see movement in the title race. And there is a huge game coming up. As we record this on Sunday, it's coming up on Sunday night. Benfica and Porto in the Portuguese Clásico. Definitely the biggest game in the Portuguese football calendar. Although, unfortunately for them, Porto not particularly in the title race this season. And so, you know, it would take quite a lot of unexpected results for them to get back into it. But Benfica, as you say, very, very much are in the title race. And this game on Sunday is going to be a very big occasion for them, because the dropping points would allow Sporting to go back ahead of them in the table. Sporting were leading the league until situation with policing issues meant they had a game cancelled, and they kind of dropped behind although having a game in hand, and something me and Barney discussed was how I don't think that's really what they would have wanted, you know, although they know that they have this game in hand, that the kind of mindset of being behind and having to chase can really affect games, and it can really affect the mindset of the players. So a very interesting situation. Benfica and Sporting will actually meet in the league at the beginning of April. That is sure to be another huge game. And Sporting still have Porto to play themselves, and that will be at the end of April. So, you know, if Benfica were to lose on Sunday, they would still have perhaps two opportunities in those games to gain points over Sporting. Of course, aside from any more surprise points dropped against smaller teams, but there's no way they want to do that. Despite Benfica losing to Porto in the cup just this week, and they have a big European tie against Rangers to follow, this game on Sunday comes sandwiched in between two really big games, but this is by far the most important of the three. So when the listeners are listening to this podcast, definitely go back and check on the result of this game between Benfica and Porto, because it's gonna have a big impact on the table. But more generally, Benfica and Sporting have both had excellent seasons, in my opinion. Sporting really since the beginning of the year. Benfica got over a slightly slow start, but they've really kicked into gear since the start of 2024. For Sporting, it's been the story of a couple of key signings making a huge difference to the team. The most obvious one being Victor Gyökeres, who has been a revelation really since joining in the summer from Coventry. There were eyebrows raised. I'm probably speaking for myself here, but there were eyebrows raised when, you know, Sporting decided to spend 20 million euros on a striker from the English Championship with 1 year left on his contract. And to be fair to the player and to be fair to the Sporting Scouting Department, he's completely surpassed pretty much everyone's expectations about just how good he's been. To put it in perspective, so far it's 31 goals and 11 assists in 34 games in all competitions. It's the type of goal and assist return that we have seen in Portugal before, but only from the types of strikers that really go on to have an impact at the elite level of football, which, you know, Portugal does produce these kind of players every now and again. At 25 years old, you know, for Gyökeres, he still has time to do that, although he's perhaps not as young as some of the strikers before him who've had that impact. It's not only Victor Gyökeres, though. I think the other key signing for me was Morten Hjulmand, Danish midfielder signed from Lecce in Serie B. Forgive me, I don't know much about Italian football. I don't know whether he played in Serie A and they got relegated. I'm not sure what the situation was, but he was signed from Lecce when they were in Serie B. He came to Sporting, to be totally honest, no one really knew anything about him. He'd followed the Portuguese league. The only thing we really knew to go off was the fact that Lecce fans were really disappointed about this move, because they thought he was going to go off to somewhere bigger than Sporting. And you know, he's really kind of lived up to that reputation. He's also been fantastic. Obviously, not a striker, so he doesn't get the same eye-catching numbers as Victor Gyökeres, but that impact that he's had in midfield has been, I think, no less important. And in general, for Sporting, the difference between them and last season, where they finished a pretty disappointing fourth place, has been just that. It's about two, three or four kind of players of real quality who maybe weren't either in the squad last season or performing at that level last season that are now making the impacts that they need. I mean, one name to pick out for me, Marcus Edwards, the English winger that I'm sure a few fans of European football will be aware of, for me, undoubtedly playing the best football of his career this season, showing in much longer patches of form for me, you know, the type of ability that we know he has, but that perhaps he struggled to show over extended periods in Portugal, which I think is probably a fair criticism. Francisco Trincão, again, for me, playing the best football of his career since he left Portugal for Sporting, didn't start that way this season either. So he's really developed and had a great patch of form recently. Players like Hidemasa Morita, Japanese midfielder, hit new heights alongside Hjulmand, and I think Hjulmand's had a big impact on him as well. So there are youngsters, the likes of Usman Diamande. He was signed from Denmark, I believe. He came with a lot of expectation, but really lived up to expectation from the beginning. But two players I think who also really need a special mention are a couple of surprise success stories from the Sporting youth team. And the two for me really are Jenny Catamo, 23-year-old winger from Mozambique. Never really cut it at Sporting. Had a couple of uninspiring loan spells at Vitória de Guimarães and Marítimo in the Portuguese league. perhaps people thought his time at Sporting was up, but he's come into the team. He's playing right wing back, and he just looks like a real attacking threat on the right hand side. And the main one that I can't stop talking about is Eduardo Quaresma, perhaps a name that people might have remembered from a few years ago when he was in a kind of lot of teams of the future. Perhaps, you know, I think he played in European youth competition. It's really hard to make it clear just what a forgotten man he was at Sporting. He'd had, you know, a youth academy product. There were high hopes, but he never really lived up to it. Had a very poor loan spell in the Portuguese league at Tondela the season they were relegated. He was then sent out to Hoffenheim in Germany. Didn't make any progress at all, made very few appearances. And it really did seem that Sporting had kind of given up on him as a player. I mean, even the manager, to a certain extent, you know, he did come back into the squad for this season, but he was riding the bench. He wasn't involved. And then it was really out of nowhere in a huge game against Porto. They had a bit of an injury crisis, but they still had more senior players like Luis Neto, who played minutes under Amorim. Amorim plucks out Eduardo Quaresma from limbo, really puts him in the starting 11. And he played, for me, the best game of his career was that game. And he has not looked back since that moment. And it's incredible how it's come out of nowhere. But what I hope this is building a picture of for Sporting is just how there's a lot of assets that have come out of nowhere, perhaps good signings, whether it be players within the team that are stepping up, youth players that previously couldn't rely on. It's all falling into place. It has a real feel of the league title winning season from 2019 when they made such an impact. They have a chance for me to go one better and do the league and cup double this year. That would really be one of the best seasons in the last 20-25 years of Sporting's history if they can pull it off. But of course they do have Benfica standing in the way, for whom they've really stood in the shadows of for the last two, maybe even three decades really, and who dominated the league last season. Wonderful squad full of wonderful players. It's their second season under Roger Schmidt, who made such an impact last season on the league, oversaw a really impressive title race, title win, I should say. Hasn't found this season quite as smooth. Perhaps, you know, he lost key players in the summer. He's had to navigate finding a new striker after selling Gonçalo Ramos to PSG. They spent 40 million euros on new strikers. Artur Cabral arrived in the summer. He looked really off the pace for the first half of the season, although, in my opinion, looks fitter and stronger now and looks much better. They spent another 20 million euros in January on Marcos Leonardo, a young Brazilian from São Paulo. And he's looked good. He's scored a lot of goals coming off the bench. But in recent weeks, he's actually had a lot of success when he's not played either of them. And he's used Rafa Silva, who is really kind of the long-serving star of this Benfica team, a player who's played for the national team and perhaps thought might move away, but never done it. But he's been using him as a kind of mobile striker recently, and that's allowed him to play David Neres and João Mario and Angel Di Maria in behind. And it's worked pretty well against smaller clubs. It wasn't great against Sporting in the first half of that cup game that they lost. So I'm not sure convinced that Schmidt will do that in every game. But for Benfica, this is a team, you know, like I said, full of real quality. There's two World Cup holders in the squad in Angel Di Maria and Otamendi. That's the luxury that Benfica have when they have a culture of selling players for tens of millions of pounds and in some cases hundreds of millions of euros. They obviously, like I said, had that slow start to the season. Very disappointing Champions League group stage where they got 4 points. They didn't win something like their first four or five games in the group stage. It was really, really disappointing. But they're really finding their form since the turn of the year. So it sets us up for fantastic climax to the season. 10 games to go, two teams playing at the top level, wonderful players, very exciting managers. Those big games in April that I flagged up are going to be really huge. But listen, I couldn't call it at the moment. It's going to be, for better, for the neutral, one of the most tight title races, full of quality, that we've had in Portugal for quite some time.
Yes, does sound quite mouthwatering. Elsewhere, Daniel Sousa has done a quite astonishing job since taking charge of Arouca back in November. At the time of Sousa's appointment, the side from Northern Portugal sat bottom of the table, having picked up just 6 points from their opening 11 games. Since then, however, Arouca have picked up 28 points and climbed all the way up to 7th. Indeed, over that period, only league leaders Benfica have picked up more points than Sousa's side. So, how has the 39-year-old managed to oversee this quite remarkable turnaround at the club, and could he perhaps now guide them into Europe, Albert?
Yeah, I mean, Arouca's a fascinating one, and I think it's hopefully helpful to give a little bit of context about the team. So, they're a really small town in the north of Portugal. It has a population of 25,000 people. It's a really, really small place. The football team was founded in 1951. They spent most of their time in the regional leagues, the lower divisions. That changed early 2000s. They get an injection of investment from, I believe, a kind of a local investor who invests in the club, and they start to get promoted. First, they get into the third division. They spend a couple of leagues there. Then in 2013, they make it to the Premier League for the first time. They actually played in Europe in 2016 after finishing fifth in the league and playing Europa League qualifiers. So unfortunately, they didn't qualify, and were in fact relegated the same year that they played in Europa League qualifiers. In many ways, Arouca were a precursor to something that would become quite common in Portugal 5 to 10 years later, with the introduction of the Europa Conference League, and Portugal's coefficient ranking, which until recently allowed the top six teams to qualify for Europe. Now, in a league where there's only really four consistent clubs at the top, that does allow for a couple of teams really to come out of nowhere and get the reward of European football. Often, this would be a kind of smaller club, the likes of Rio Ave, Gil Vicente, or similar teams that would assemble a good little team, find themselves a promising manager, put a good season together, and get the benefit of qualifying for Europe. But again, so often what we would see is that the following season, all of their best players would either be nicked by other clubs, or because these are not clubs with big budgets, the best players would be loan players. Probably the manager would move on to. They would suffer in the transfer market and have a very disappointing follow-up season. In the 3 seasons that the Europa Conference League has existed, six Portuguese clubs have played in the qualifiers. Not a single one has ever made it to the group stage, often because of exactly what I've just described, where the squad and managerial team that they go into their season with the Conference League qualifiers in is a completely different one from the one that earned them that position in the first place. Arouca were that team last year. So under Armando Evangelista, they had a great season. They finished fifth in the league, qualified for the Europa Conference League. What happens next? The manager leaves to go manage in Brazil. Multiple key players left, and they had to really start the whole season from scratch. But things looked very different for Arouca. They signed a number of interesting players, lots from Spain, from South America, a mixture of signings of players from a kind of perhaps under-scouted leagues, underappreciated leagues like Uruguay. They signed a couple of players from, and players from more prestigious leagues like Spain, but players who perhaps had a point to prove in their career, and where a change of scenery would make a difference to them. Christo Gonzalez and Jason were the two best examples of that. Christo played for Real Madrid Castilla, I believe, and moved around a lot in Spain, and actually was signed from Udinese in Italy, so a bit of a journeyman. Jason had played at Valencia, Getafe, Alaves, a host of other clubs in Spain. Not only good signings, but they also went for a good manager. Not in Daniel Sousa, but in Daniel Ramos initially, who had achieved great things with Santa Clara not long ago, was very well respected in the league. And it all looked like this was going to be the team to buck the trend, actually do well in the Europa League, go to Conference League qualifiers, and have a positive second season, use that momentum well. To cut a long story short, it really wasn't. They actually started pretty positively. They won the first league game of the season. They drew the next three. They won the first leg of their Europa Conference League qualifier. Those new signings that I mentioned, Christo and Jason, impressed. They had a Spanish striker already on the books in Rafa Mujica, who did well. But they lost the second leg of the Europa League qualifier against Brand 3-1, despite being 2-1 up after the first leg. To put it mildly, after that, the wheels really did come off. They lost seven league games in a row. They plummeted to 18th, which is the last place in the Portuguese Premier League table. Naturally, Ramos was sacked, and the season kind of became about survival mode. But the Arouca board really deserve a lot of credit, because they could have gone down the route which so many Portuguese clubs do in that situation, hiring one of the many managers who does the rounds of these teams, without wanting to use a stupid phrase. They could have done, gone for a Big Sam, basically that kind of manager that we see around Europe. There's plenty of choices, but they went for Daniel Sousa. who had only managed one club previously in the Premier League, Gil Vicente. I remember when he signed for Gil Vicente, they were in a very similar position. He took over Gil Vicente the season after they'd qualified for the Europa Conference League and were struggling in that following season. They had a very promising start under him. But for whatever reason, it wasn't sustained. I think he lasted 25 games. It was pretty respectable, but there was always that feeling that he could be an interesting coach. And in Arouca, he's found a team where he can really prove that. The impact was instantaneous. They beat Boavista 4-0 away from home in his first game in charge. They won three out of his fourth games in charge, and they drew the fourth. They went on to win six out of their next nine games, including a memorable win over Porto at home. As you say, they climbed to seventh in the table on the cusp of European qualification again after being dead last. You know, the transformation on the pitch was remarkable. And since Danchez has come in, they've got the same amount of points, as you said, as Sporting and only two less than Benfica. They've scored more goals than any other club other than Sporting. They played fantastic football. It's brave attacking football. It's about fast build-up, trusting your defenders to build out from the back, dynamic attacking players, leaders in midfield. And they really deserve all the accolades that they're getting. Of course, Daniel Sousa himself deserves a lot of the credit. For me, it comes down to two things. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I always say that, in my opinion, 90% of football management, it's about giving your players confidence. And that's not just about, you know, telling them they're amazing. It's also about giving them a style of football that they can believe in, that they want to play, that they feel confident playing, and that they know that they can achieve it week in, week out. That makes them feel like accomplished players. And Daniel Sousa's done that. He's cultivated an attitude in that Arouca side where they feel unbeatable. They feel that they can go toe-to-toe with any team in the league, both in terms of fitness and also on a technical level, as they did against Porto. And that when they play smaller clubs, that those clubs are not going to be able to keep up with them. You know, the front three of Mujica, Cristo, Jason has been fantastic. Somebody's dubbed them the Spanish Armada already. I tried to get something off the ground myself with Jason and the Arucanauts. It didn't land, but alas, no, it's a great club all over the pitch. Morlaye Silla, Guinean winger who was already at the team, compliments those Spanish players fantastically. 33-year-old veteran midfielder, club captain, David Simão in midfield, in my opinion, one of the league's most underrated players. Someone with a lot of class, a lot of quality. But look, they've got solid players at the back. Sousa's getting the best out of the players that were there and the new signings. You know, he's got his right back, Thiago Ishgaio, playing at a better level than his older brother, the more famous Ricardo Ishgaio at Sporting. You know, so it's been a really, really impressive season. And the only thing that remains, of course, is where do they go next? In the short term, if they keep this form up, I think they've got a good chance of closing the 5-point gap between them and Moreirense and stealing that sixth place spot. I think the 10-point gap between themselves and Vitória in fifth is probably a step too far with only 10 games to go. In the mid to long term, it's highly unlikely that players like Rafa Mujica will still be at the club next season. You know, he could feasibly end the season with 20 league goals, and that would be an incredible achievement. But players like that don't hang around at Arouca, if we're being frank. He would make them a lot of money in the transfer market. And we're back to that same old story. Can they keep their best players? Can they reinvent themselves again if needed? One thing to keep an eye on, which might seem unrelated, is the upcoming elections for the Porto presidency. Now, if I tell you that before he was a manager, Daniel Sousa was an analyst and an assistant coach at these clubs in order: Porto, Chelsea, Tottenham, Zenit, Shanghai SIPG, and Marseille. I'm sure the listeners can work out which manager he was the assistant to. André Villas-Boas, and who's currently challenging Pinto da Costa for the presidency at FC Porto? André Villas-Boas. So who knows where Daniel Sousa will end up next as manager after a good season at Arouca. But for now, Arouca, it's a really lovely story to follow. It's a great team to watch. I watched them on Friday night demolish Gidi Shav's 5-1. Mm-hmm. Fantastic performance. So for now, just enjoy the ride, and who knows what the future will hold.
Cracking. Yeah, good story indeed. Elsewhere, Vizela authored one of the greatest chapters in recent Portuguese footballing history when they achieved back-to-back promotions to climb from the third tier to the top flight a few years ago under the guidance of the iconic manager Álvaro Pacheco. There is, however, a feeling in some parts that the club has since got a bit too big for its boots under new owners. having churned through a series of managers over the last 15 months and now finding themselves languishing at the bottom of the table. Tell us more about the curious case of Vizela, Albert.
Yeah, and Vizela's a really interesting one. You know, I thought it would be interesting to talk about a team at a different end of the Premier League table because, unfortunately, they are right down at the bottom at the moment. Very similar to Arouca, they're a club who spent the majority of their existence in the lower leagues, mainly in the second and third divisions, but they had that amazing story under now infamous, well, legendary manager Álvaro Pacheco, where they had two successive promotions to go from the third division to the Primeira Liga in what was a really meteoric rise. It was also notable because of the manner in which they did it. You know, Álvaro Pacheco really went in, made his mark on the team. He got them playing exciting football, attacking football, and crucially, you know, got them promoted twice with largely the same squad, which meant that his team qualified Primeira Liga made largely of the same players who'd never played in the Primeira Liga before. One example of that, a player I love, Kiko Bondozo, signed for Pacheco when they were in the third division. He'd only ever played third division football before, promoted twice in two seasons, not only performed in the Primeira Liga, but outshone a lot of players worth an awful lot more money than he was. He did eventually leave for a fee of about €1 million. And for a club of his other size, that's a big fee. So it was a really great story. But look, it didn't last forever. Unfortunately, Pacheco, you know, they kind of struggled. They did survive in Primeira Liga, but they struggled. There was a takeover in about 2022. It's actually hard to find out exactly what happened. I'm not even exactly sure who the new owners are. Some people say it's a group of investors from Malaysia, from China, from the United States, perhaps a mixture of all three. But the warning signs were there when they instilled Tulipa as the under-23 manager, a manager who was already an established Primeira Liga manager. So it was a bit of a strange situation that he would manage the under-23s. Anyway, lo and behold, after a patch of sticky form, Pacheco's sacked and they bring in Tulipa as the main manager. So the writing was on the wall then. Unfortunately, he didn't even last, although he did guide them to their top finish ever in the history of their league. They finished in 11th place, although he left at the end of the season. They started bringing in a couple of young Spanish managers. The first, Pablo Vilar, 37 years old. I had to write these down because he managed previously, his only experience was FK Pironi in the Slovenian second division and FK Riteria in Lithuania. Hardly managerial pedigree, only lasted, I think, something like 8 games. He was sacked. They have brought in another Spanish manager in Ruben de la Barrera, who had a bit more managerial experience, Deportivo La Coruña in Spain, Albacete. He actually managed the El Salvador national team. So a bit more managerial experience. But like I said, they're bottom of the table. They have 17 points from 23 games. I don't necessarily want to write them off. I think they have played some good football under de la Barrera, but it's not good enough to just play promising football and lose a lot of games. There's a few positives. Bizarrely, they currently have the one of the league's top scorers in Samuel Assend, a great striker who I always make the joke that the most nailed on event in Portuguese football is Samuel Assend scoring the consolation goal in a 5-1 loss for Vizela. That's like the most obvious thing to happen at the moment. But yeah, look, it's there are a couple of signs. They signed a couple of interesting players in January. Domingos Quina used to play for West Ham and Watford. He looks okay. But yeah, it does really seem, unfortunately, like Vizela are a team who, you know, flew too close to the sun, perhaps. They worked so hard to get into that position and perhaps thought, oh, maybe we can push it here. Pushed it a little bit too far. And unfortunately, things are not looking great for Vizela.
Yeah, extremely interesting stuff, Albert. And I think with Portuguese football, the landscape is ever-evolving. You've obviously got the big guns, the big teams, but I think within that sort of crop of major outfits, there are interesting storylines. But if you do look beyond that, like with any league that we would typically cover on the podcast, if you look beyond the major outfits, if you look beyond the so-called big teams, then that's when you really start to find the most intriguing narratives, the most intriguing storylines. Well, Albert, thank you so much for coming on and telling us all about Portuguese football, what's been happening this season, the last few seasons, and what we can expect, in the short to medium term future as well. I'm sure the listeners will have loved it also. If they want to hear more of what you do, where can they find you? Where can they find you on social media? Where can they find you on podcast platforms?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find the Long Ball Football podcast. We should be anywhere you get your podcast. We're definitely in all the main places. Portuguese football is a lot of fun. You know, the last 10 games of the season is going to be great. There's a great title race, loads of stuff happening. We try and cover it all every week. We cover all the teams, not just the top four. So there's loads to listen to. We're on Twitter, currently known as X, at Long Ball Football. If you want to follow us there, there's some decent tweets and a lot of nonsense. But yeah, we're most places.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, and I can vouch for what you guys do. It really is excellent content, and yeah, I think what we've heard over the last half an hour or so was an insight into just how knowledgeable you and, of course, Barney as well are about Portuguese football. Well, we're going to wrap up the first section of the podcast there. We're going to dial in Michael Jones, who's going to tell us all about the latest goings on in Italy. We'll be right back.
My thanks to Ali and Albert for passing the baton on so smoothly to myself, Ruri Barlow, and Michael Jones, who I'm joined by just now. How are things with you, Michael?
Yeah, they're good, thank you. I feel like we're getting the first sort of feelings of spring here in the UK, which is nice. And yeah, I feel like Italian football has kind of followed suit in the way that the season's kind of turned some new corners, and what we may have anticipated a month or two ago is completely different to the picture we're looking at now, which we're going to touch upon in this episode. So yeah, really excited to see what lies ahead and what's been recently happening in Serie A. What about you?
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, as you say, in theory, spring arriving here, we had a couple of very warm weeks at the start of February, and I am kind of patently aware that sometimes the start of these podcasts, certainly for us, feel like weather updates from just where we are. But on that note, yeah,
I think it's just because you're always in Spain, isn't it? So I'm always just really in tune,
always
and I feel
comparison.
Like I have a duty. But you must get that on every single phone call you're on with family or something, I'm guessing.
Most of the time, yeah. But to be fair, it was the coldest I've ever been in Spain on Saturday. It was hailing, sleeting, snowing, all sorts of it was going on. And yeah, I mistakenly thought that my trip to Getafe to the Coliseum would not include kind of rain when I bought my ticket. And of course, I was absolutely soaked by about 15 minutes into the point where I had to eat my sandwich before halftime. For fear that it would be too soggy at the interval. But that's quite enough of that. We'll drive straight into the Italian football. And yeah, one that I've got certainly an interest in, because ahead of Napoli and Barcelona's first leg in their Champions League, many could have been forgiven for being confused when glancing over to the dugout and seeing an unrecognisable figure in that dugout. It wasn't a rejuvenated, replenished Walter Mazzarri, but in many ways, a replacement who symbolised just that. Despite having no prior first-team managerial experience at club level, Napoli's new henchman, Francesco Calzona, has made a fantastic start to the gig. Tell us more, Michael.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, I must admit, I hadn't been looking at my phone too much that day before the game, and I tuned in about 10 minutes in, and hence maybe the line of questioning as well. And I looked over and I was like, who on earth is that? And turns out to be Carl's owner. And okay, the immediate signs were okay. He managed to get a respectable draw against an under-strength Barcelona. But since then, you know, we've really seen signs of building. But in the last week, those signs and that positivity surrounding Napoli and Calzona has skyrocketed. They have had a monumentous week, in a week that's probably been a rare positive, a rare shining light in what's been a miserable season. But maybe more than that, and maybe the signs that they're able to turn things around. Only in the midweek last week, they absolutely thumped Sassuolo. Despite going a goal behind, they came back to win 6-1. And that set up this brilliant tie versus Juventus, who have been struggling for the same form they had up until about January as of late. And Napoli ended up taking the lead twice in that game to win 2-1. It was a rebound off a late penalty. Giacomo Raspadori capitalised on the save from Szczesny from Victor Osimhen's penalty to give Napoli another 3 points. But it's added to the positivity, and it's not just results that Calzone has generated, but he's really generated a positive attitude within the players, which is really important, which I'll come on to shortly. But he's also got them playing the kind of football, the closest type of football I think we've seen Napoli play since Luciano Spalletti was getting Napoli playing the best stuff we've probably seen from them this century, last season. And that shouldn't come as a surprise. Calzone was Spalletti's assistant last season and the season before. But that was before he, that was as he took on the Slovakia job in August 2022. And he successfully guided Slovakia to the Euros for this summer. And he's still taking that post until at least the end of the tournament. Obviously, his future is very early days in his Napoli career as well. But I think whatever happens over the next few months, his name's suddenly much more on the map than it was. And I guess that kind of begs the question of how Calzone has ended up where he has. And that's where I personally think it gets really interesting, because Calzone before Spalletti, he'd also assisted other managers. He'd assisted Eusebio Di Francesco at Cagliari, I think it was. But before that, he'd basically followed Maurizio Sarri all over Italy. And he'd followed, so he was a part of the Maurizio Sarri team that had a great period in charge of Napoli. And that was, it was the good work that he'd done there which had led to him getting the Slovakia job, because one thing Napoli and Slovakia had in common for many years was Marek Hamšík being a key player for both of them. And it was Marek Hamšík's recommendation, apparently, which led to him getting the job. And now Slovakia coincidentally have one of Napoli's most, Napoli and Slovakia share another very important player, Stanislav Lobotka, who's also been key during this run. But yeah, what I should really stress is that Calzone had a very average playing career. I think he played a few games in Serie B for Arezzo in the mid-90s before retiring and starting a coffee business at the age of 30. And at the time, after, I think he had a brief spell playing for a team called Tegaletto as well in the lower reaches of Italian football. And during that time, he started coaching there as well. And they wanted him to take the full-time gig as a coach. He wanted to focus on his coffee business. And instead, lo and behold, Maurizio Sarri took that job. And then since then, as Sarri's career kind of kicked off from there, you know, 5 years later, he was managing at Pescara, then Arezzo, who were, again, an established Serie B team at that point, around the time Conte was manager there as well, before taking on the Hellas Verona job and Perugia, all these jobs before Napoli. He was followed all that time through Calzone. So they had this extremely close symbiotic relationship that's been extremely fruitful. And yeah, he's done brilliantly in charge of Slovakia, like only two defeats to Portugal during their qualifying campaign. Other than that, it was a near perfect record. I think they dropped 2 points against Luxembourg at the start of the campaign as well. But yeah, one of the most impressive things he's managed to do in such a short space of time, which is such a damning indictment on Rudy Garcia and Walter Mazzarri, is that he's got that tune out of Victor Osimhen and Richard Carrara-Skellia again, that neither Mazzarri or Garcia have been able to do. And one of the things he's constantly spoken about in the press has been that need for positivity and changing the psychological state of these Napoli players. And if you think about that and the way that Hamšík endorsed him for the national team job in Slovakia, I think it speaks volumes about the personality. I'm not sure Sarri always has come across as the warmest character in football, whether that's been in Italy or over the shores in England as well. But it may go a long way in explaining why Sarri's tactics were maybe better implemented earlier on during his career and why Calzone was there. You know, it's an easy statement to make now, and it's very coincidental, and well, it might be coincidental that he's made a very good start, but I think they'll be really confident. You know, he's made some interesting tactical tweaks as well. Juan Jesus has returned to the defence. Hamed Traore, a January signing from Bournemouth on loan from there, after they spent a lot of money on him, but he's not really done anything in the Premier League. Also battled with area as well. He's looked really energised and positive in those performances. But yeah, they had 71% possession against Juventus. They've looked really fun to watch on the ball as well. They're really exploiting the flanks, really quick, intricate 1-2s. He's certainly giving them that freedom, similar to what Daniele De Rossi is doing at Roma at the moment. So again, begs the question, is this just a really good new manager bounce effect, which I suspect you might get off a younger manager coming in, following the footsteps of the dinosaurs, you might call, of Mazzarri and Garcia. But yeah, really positive signs. Suddenly, you get the feeling that they might be back in the picture in the top four race, which will be really interesting to see how they get on. Suddenly, they're only 8 points adrift, which sounds a lot, but it's been worse previously, and they've been languishing around. I think they were ninth when Mazzarri got them sacked. They're now up to seventh with those back-to-back wins, unbeaten in the three games under him as well. And yeah, I think despite the form of teams above them, which I'm sure we'll come on to shortly, I think there'll be teams suddenly looking a lot more anxiously over their shoulders to the team coming up from the south of Italy again.
Plenty to dig your teeth into there, and it'll be interesting, especially to see if Calzona does keep doing well, whether Napoli try to hold on to him, and Slovakia's of his opinion on that. If the Neapolitans have any hope of making a late break into the top four, they will be relying on Atalanta or Bologna to slow down, particularly the latter, who won Sunday's mega tie in spectacular fashion, courtesy of podcast favourite Lewis Ferguson, who completed I Rosso Blues' turnaround to make it 6 wins on the bounce for Thiago Motta. January proved Bologna's star assets cannot be easily bought. In the race for Champions League football, can they be easily caught, Michael?
No, absolutely not. They're such a force to be reckoned with in Italian football right now. I think it's safe to say they've been the biggest success story of the season, bar Inter Milan, but certainly a team that's kind of come from the outside a little bit. But I think those who've been following Thiago Motta's work, particularly at Bologna, I think he's always had a reputation since moving into management of wanting to do things differently. But we're really seeing that being matched with results this season. And Bologna, yeah, like you said, 6 wins on the bounce. It was a really emphatic victory, which led to mass celebrations in the comeback victory away to Atalanta. Ademola Lookman had put them in the lead for a rebound. They levelled through Joshua Zirkzee. He finished on the spot. His composure, we discussed that on the podcast earlier this season, has been really refreshing to see for a player who struggled for consistency for so long in his career. And he's kind of really embraced that calmer side of his personality and his game, I think. Before Lewis Ferguson, who's kind of the opposite, I think, of it, kind of like blood and thunder player, absolutely smashes one home from the edge of the area to, it might have been just inside actually, past Carnesecchi, to give Bologna the win, which led to mass celebrations in the street. There's a brilliant scene of Riccardo Orsolini, who's been one of the longer serving players at Bologna, who certainly knows what it's been like during the slightly more difficult times, but he's been there since he was 22, 21, I think it was, back in 2018. It's a great scene after the game where he comes through the skylight in his car and starts joining in with a chant surrounded by all the fans as well. But the plaudits are coming in rightly for Ferguson and Zirkzee. We've discussed a lot on this podcast, but you know, you can look elsewhere and there's been some huge success stories all over the pitch. Jens Erdgaard scored a big goal recently, I think in their win over Fiorentina. We've seen Giovanni Fabian, a young midfielder who just 21 years of age, who signed last summer from Inter Milan after spending the season on loan at Regina. Last season, he stands at 6'1", but he's been a really positive light for them. And it'll be interesting to see if Inter Milan actually exercise that buyback off him. He's an under-21 international at the moment, but he's really broken through this season. He's another to really keep their eye out for their national team going into this summer. We saw Samer Alazouzi score a crunch goal for them recently as well. And yeah, I think one of the things that we've discussed, Motta and his tactics, and what I think is doubly impressive, it was over Christmas, it looked like they were kind of stuttering their way and risked falling out of top four. They'd endured quite a miserable run of form before that, but you know, nothing too alarming, but it was certainly something that they'd struggled with a bit, but there had been some really troubling performances. I think they'd lost 3-0 away to Udinese, had a really poor draw with Bologna. They lost at the start of the year to Cagliari. And then since then, they've picked up massive wins. You know, they got that, they bounced back over Lecce, getting a 4-0 victory back there. And then the recent wins over Fiorentina 2-0, Lazio 2-1, Atalanta 2-1. All of these a big Champions League rivals as well, or likely to be over the season. And they've the manner of these performances have also been emphatic to the extent where you do wonder what psychological impact it will be having on their opponents. And I think that's one of the biggest statements you can make as a manager, to get your team constantly coming over these increasingly difficult hurdles. Because as we discussed earlier as well, Atalanta are a team who've been on brilliant form over the past few weeks. You know, they've been one of the main features of the podcast in 2024. And I guess before we move on, I think it's going to be really interesting. You mentioned that they cannot be bought, and they certainly couldn't be in January. And it's going to be really interesting to see what fares in the summer. I mean, Xerxes already been linked with kind of 80 million euro price tags, which is probably double to what it was even a month ago. Lewis Ferguson, I expect, won't be going cheap either, and there'll be interesting number of the players like Fabian, like we said. But big credit to Jerry Saputo, the Canadian owner, initially was a minority stakeholder in the club. Since then, he's got 99.9% shares in the club. And since then, he's helped oversee the club come back from Serie B in 2015, where they've stayed up ever since. Been a gradual improvement. And I think one of Saputo's real strengths has been showing patience in managers. You know, with Sinisa Mihajlovic, everybody knew the struggles that he went on off the pitch, and Saputo was able to let him go back and forth to the job as he so felt comfortable. And you look at the state of some of the other clubs in Italy during that time, and I don't think the same could have been said. And I think the tributes have been really touching to Mihajlovic since he's sadly left us about 18 months ago now, but maybe a bit shorter. But I think, you know, the same can be said for Motta. He's clearly given him time. Motta took over the club when they're in a relegation zone. I went to that first game that Motta took charge of, a really drab draw against Sampdoria. And I was watching Xerxes on the pitch at the time thinking, what an FU offering in this game, and what a transformation he's had since then. And yeah, I think this is a real story of patience, sustainability. He's spoken a lot about the need for financial sustainability in Italian football. Obviously, the climate isn't very befitting of that at the moment, and that's what may force his hand, but he's certainly a sensible owner who would recognise that. But, you know, what a boost Champions League football would be. And Motta, in fact, may be the biggest priced asset they may struggle to keep hold of this summer. But whatever it is, it's been an absolutely historic season for Bologna. And having come through such a difficult run of fixtures, they've got Inter Milan on Saturday, which is interesting because Inter Milan have that crunch Atletico second leg coming up, which is, I think, going to be an epic. So they might have a bit of a weakened Inter Milan side there. And then they've got Empoli, Salernitana, Frosinone coming up in next year, Udinese as well. Some teams are really struggling. Got a bit of a tough run at the end, but again, a chance to really build up ahead of steam and try and get a bit of a gap. And even, dare I say it, start to close the gap to the teams above them. You know, Juventus are only 6 points above. They've only won one in five, and they are really struggling for form right now. So yeah, fascinating times in the top four race, but Bologna are not exceeding any kind of outside pressure as it stands, despite what would be such a monumental achievement for them.
Yeah, it certainly is a monumental achievement. And one of the sides that probably in past years has been very much admired, especially from a distance, are Bologna's local rivals, who are suffering on the opposite trajectory, and that is Sassuolo. I Neroverde dropped to second bottom in Serie A after losing a crunch match to fellow relegation contenders Hellas Verona, having sacked their manager, then lost 6-1 to Napoli and missing their star man. What hope do Sassuolo have of surviving?
Yeah, it's difficult. I think many ways, I think they've kind of relied on what they've been relying on this season, which is individual brilliance at times. But like you said, Domenico Berardi, it's not really clear how long he's going to be out for, but it doesn't look like he's going to be back too soon. And he's been fundamental to all their success since they've been in Serie A over the past, I think it's 11 years now. And it's been a really sorry state of affairs. It feels a bit harsh on the way that the results have unfolded for Alessio Dionisi towards the end. But I must admit, this is a manager that I've never been truly convinced was the perfect man to succeed Roberto De Zerbi since taking on the project. He was certainly maybe a bit of an outside indie choices De Zerbi arguably was at the time, and those kind of brave decisions of respect have to be taken to try and maybe garner the success that where they wouldn't have the more typical managerial pull when he came up after leading Empoli up, and he hadn't actually had any Serie A experience at the time of Sassuolo. I think first season 11, second season 13, but that were much closer to the relegation picture than that position suggests. And then this season, they've had terrible teams around them all season, but suddenly they've started to pick up results, and Sassuolo haven't, and they find themselves 19th, almost rooted bottom. We discussed that terrible result versus Napoli at the weekend. Things have only just got worse. They lost to Hellas Verona, another local rival there too. And yeah, I think the further they got away, I mean, I think Dionisi had just got completely lost in his playing identity with Sassuolo. Sassuolo team known for playing attractive football over the last few years. Possession base, you say we had that Francesco had some great years with them. So did Roberto De Zerbi. People forget that Massimiliano Allegri actually took them up from Serie C to Serie B back in the noughties as well. So they've got this real proud history of unearthing great managers. And I think that's what they were hoping to do again with Dionisi. And I don't think Dionisi's done his reputation enough harm for him not to be able to bounce back and get a Serie A job, far from it. But I don't think he's built on it in the way that his predecessors have by any means. And what I thought was really noticeable and telling is this is a team that almost looks scared to play with the ball nowadays. And you look at them even last season, a team that averaging often upwards of 55% possession. And this is a team this season that are often averaging below 40% possession. And not just the way that they use the ball, but they had an increase in reliance on the likes of Berardi and Andrea Pinamonti. It's a big outlay for a team in that position, 20 million euros in the summer. And I just think some of the players who have been brought in, Daniel Bellocco is another good player, but they're those kind of young, good, breakout players are becoming more of a rarity at Sassuolo, whereas that didn't used to be the case. A man, Lloriente, a man we really were praising last season, he's only scored one goal so far this season. He's had a really difficult campaign, the Frenchman. And then if you look further afield, you can look at Nedim Bajrami, brought in from Empoli, who just hasn't really hit the heights that he did when he first arrived on the Serie A scene, and had a really fruitful relationship with Dionisio and Empoli, and him went up together a couple of years ago. And I think some of the transfer policy, they and team that have always invested very top heavy on players, always focused a lot on the attack, as you can tell from the Pinamonti outlay last summer. And that sort of neglected defence, I think, has really, really come back to bite them now. And they did sign Josh Doig, who is an exciting prospect by all means, but not the most defensively sound, especially unfamiliar in a back four, which is what they've typically been playing. And then they've got the likes of Boris Rashic and Samuel Castillejo, who both came in from Valencia, who Castillejo especially is not. I think Rashic scored his first goal in that defeat to Napoli, but Castillejo, 16 games, 6 starts, no goals, no assists, has had minimal impact and is the sign of a dwindling career, I think it's fair to say, from what we've seen in Italy, at least. I don't know about his time in Spain too much, but the loan suggests that's not been a huge success either. And yeah, I think it's really worrying. They brought in Davide Ballardini, who got relegated with Cremonese last season. They kept him on for this season, but got sacked 5 games in. So similar to Salernitana's situation that we discussed on the last podcast episode, becoming increasingly worrying. They do have much more individual quality than the teams around them, which makes you think that they could still have a good stab at staying up. And I think Bellardini's been brought in to solidify the defence to build from the attack, which they've not done for a number of years. So whether the players can adjust to that is another big question. But yeah, hugely concerning times. And I think whatever happens, they'll be looking to restart the project in the summer. They do stay up, they go down, I think it'd be hugely damaging for the club, because they'll be stripped of all those star players on low fees who'll depart from them. But it may at least allow them to, they may have to go for the much bigger rebuild than they probably had anticipated a year or two ago.
Yeah, fascinating stuff on Roberto De Zerbi's former team as opposed to his future one. We're going to take a very brief break and then we will be back with more on Spain and La Liga.
Yeah, so we turn the tables now. I'm going to be asking you the questions in Spain. And nearly every time we've dealt with Valencia on this podcast, Barlow, it's felt like it's been for the wrong reasons. And if you had to give a state of the nation, it might not be entirely positive. Yet, one of the problems right now is not the football. Ruben Baraja was almost unanimously questioned when he arrived in a difficult situation. But a year down the line, it's hard to argue he's doing anything but an excellent job, as we've seen last weekend during their contentious and well-seen draw versus Real Madrid.
Yeah, absolutely. I would explain what happened, but I think it's done the globe in terms of Jude Bellingham and his last minute header. And yeah, it's not really what we're here to talk about, because I think Valencia, like as you say, Baraja was kind of pretty questioned when he came in. I mean, this is a manager who was obviously brilliant as a player, brilliant as a Valencia player and involved in those title wins back in the early 2000s, but somebody that as a coach had never really proven it, and he'd bounced around in the second division, done fine at various teams, but never kind of pulled up any trees. And so when he came in with 3 months to go as kind of this rescue job from Gennaro Gattuso, who, as we know, doesn't generally make it to the end of the season, it was worrying, because it was a Valencia side that was very much in danger of relegation, and right up until the final day they ended up getting just enough to get out of trouble. But yeah, it was a concerning time for Valencia, whereas now it feels like they're separated from that, and that kind of core of youngsters, which is what he's built this Valencia side around, Christian Mosquera, who's a pacey and pretty kind of very sort of on it central defender. He's very hard to kind of force mistakes out of. You've got Jarek, who's another kind of young defender who looks pretty promising. Javi Guerra is the jewel in the crown, and he's already been scouted by name or insert name of top European club, because he's just excellent. The way he turns away from players, the way he finds space, the way he has a talent for hitting those kind of big moments. Diego Lopez up front, Fran Perez, kind of trickier, quicker, younger wingers. They're both kind of interesting players to watch for the future. And uniting that with, as has become the case for Valencia, kind of either aging or kind of very, in general, very kind of established pros in La Liga in that kind of mid-table zone. And yeah, this is Valencia side that probably is the least talented over the last kind of 3-4 years since Marcelino left, but probably the one I have the most kind of confidence or faith in terms of what I'm going to get out of them at the weekend. And yeah, some of those youngsters that I mentioned, they're differing levels of talent, but the kind of general feeling that they give and the general impression that you get of Valencia is that this is a football team. And I mean that in the sense of this is a collective, this is a side that fights for each other, a team that doesn't necessarily, isn't going to give up games easily, which is something that has happened in the past. And you look at kind of those more senior figures, Sergi Canos, who made a huge financial sacrifice to come in and play for the side. He's been very good. Hugo Duro, who's a kind of very hard-working striker who should be Uruguayan just because of the way he plays, but is actually Spanish. And he's been effective this season. And Jose Gaya, who of course is the, I'd say, already legendary captain now, is who's guiding this kind of ship. But under Baraja, you get a manager that has brought so much more stability to Mestalla, and a Mestalla that feels a connection with the side. We saw that on Saturday night, where Real Madrid got a very vociferous reaction, as they always do at Mestalla, it has to be said. But it feels like we're some way removed to kind of slightly empty Mestalla stands, and it feels like Valencia feel a connection with this football team, even if they know they're not the best, and even if there is obviously disappointment with the investment of where they are. They're on the fringes of this European race. They could probably still get in. I probably don't have too much faith in them doing so. I think there are other sides that might finish ahead of them. But with Baraja, you get a coach that, because I think he's not young, it's not his kind of first few jobs, he's not a coach that seems to be and probably isn't going to be going for kind of the bigger jobs. You get somebody that's experienced kind of the bad side of Valencia, in a sense, and that kind of fighting for relegation. There's huge doubts around the side. You've got problems coming out of your ears. He's not a manager that's going to complain too much, whereas the likes of Jose Bordalas, who I think did a very good job with this Valencia side at the time, he's ambitious. He wants more. He's going to demand more from the board. The likes of Javi Gracia, promises were broken to him in the first few months of his tenure. He ended up leaving kind of under quite a cloud. And you saw that with Gattuso as well, who ended up resigning, feeling that he was kind of impotent in his role and didn't quite have enough power or enough kind of resources from above to do so. And Baraja's he's going to get on with the job. Does he want more players? Yeah. Does he want better investment? Does he want Peter Lim to take the club forward, or probably more accurately, get out of the club and then have someone else do so? Yes, but he's not going to complain. He's going to get on with the job. He's going to ensure that his Valencia, in inverted commas, are okay. And yeah, he's holding this side together, him along with Pepelu in midfield, who's a really smart pickup, 5 million from Levante in Segunda. And he's probably the one Jenga piece, in inverted commas, that I'd say this Valencia side has, because he adds balance, he adds kind of a composure in midfield, he allows everyone else to get on with his jobs, he sits in his role, and he ensures that things are going kind of well. And right now, with these kind of this group of youngsters, with the way the club is, with the situation they're in, I think it's genuinely hard to think of a better manager that Valencia could have at this point in time. Because as I say, I think anybody that maybe had kind of grander aspirations or was touted for grander aspirations, that ambition, and I'm not saying Baraja doesn't have ambition, but more so that he's comfortable knowing the situation Valencia are in, as opposed to somebody that's trying to move their career on, and the way that he came into the side, I think that would end up causing more problems. Whereas Baraja is very conscious of what's around him, and I think the fans are too. And as much as they may not like where Valencia are, as much as they may not appreciate what Peter Lim is doing, they've come to a kind of an understanding of that. And Baraja is just going to get on with it and ensure that his Valencia are doing okay.
That's great to hear. And what a player he was as well, from what I remember, at least anyway. Yeah, I guess moving away from league football, we've seen Athletic Club make the Copa del Rey final in 3 of the last 5 years. But after the battering Atletico Madrid into submission, they have to be the strong favourites for the title against Real Mallorca. That's the first time that will be the case in the 6 finals they have reached in the past 40 years since that they won it. And standing in their way is the wily Javier Aguirre, known as El Vasco, the Basque. The semi-finals felt symbolic of all 4 of these clubs this season in some weird way, Barlow.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm very aware that I'm being superficial and kind of crunching down kind of 2,500 minutes of football into a few kind of pithy lines and whatnot. But I mean, that is kind of the job. And yeah, you mentioned Aguirre there, and Wiley is exactly the kind of the word that describes him. It kind of reminds me of kind of Wiley Coyote in a way, because he feels like he's just been there forever, and it feels like around every corner he ends up being there, and he's this cartoonish character in some ways. And it was very much his character and the character that he's imparted on this Mallorca side that got them through this tie against Real Sociedad. They drew 1-1 in San Sebastian, and it went to penalties. And it was Dominic Greif, the substitute goalkeeper, who ended up making the crucial save from Oyarzabal in the penalty shootout, and Bryce Mendes in normal time that eventually got them through. It was a Real Sociedad side that you get the feeling that all season they've been looking for a striker, and there's a very brief period where it looked like Umar Sadiq was going to come back from injury and be that striker, but ultimately it seems to always end up falling to Mikel Oyarzabal to perform that role. And this season he's done okay when he's not been injured, but he's not that out and out number 9. And even Alexander Isak, who was flawed during his time in Real Sociedad, and I had many a kind of internal rocky debate with myself about whether they could do better than him, basically, for a striker. But since he's departed, it's true that Oyarzabal has been forced central, that Real Sociedad have felt like they're just missing that something in the final third. And so yeah, I'm not, I think my biggest criticism of Real Sociedad this season is, what does a Real Sociedad goal look like? I'm not quite sure. It used to be kind of fullbacks getting to the byline and pulling it back. Then there was a stage earlier in the season where Mikel Merino and Bryce Mendes kind of arriving from that second line into the box was very much what they kind of looked for. But it feels like they've made a shift to a more offensive side this season, but they've got a weaker defence in the process, and they've not had that striker to put away those goals. And Mallorca, yeah, the kind of the image that came out of this for Mallorca, I mean, Dominic Greif was the hero, but before the penalties, there was Javier Aguirre laughing and joking and kind of having a good time and winding up his players. before a penalty shootout, the biggest penalty shootouts, the biggest kind of game in many of these players' careers. And even kind of when you look at the penalty shootout, all of them kind of looked pretty calm, apart from Sergi Darder, who scored the winning penalty, who's a local Mallorca lad. This is his first season back. He's one of their most expensive signings ever. And he looked like he was, I'm trying to work out what's not going to get us suspended from Indian iTunes, but he looked like he was not having a good time with that penalty. He admitted as much afterwards, but he did end up scoring it. And yeah, that was, it feels like it was partly down to Aguirre in the way that he minimizes the pressure and really takes it off his players and makes them kind of feel like a group and makes them feel like they're kind of having fun at work. Moving on to that second semi-final, Athletic. Yeah, it feels like that 3-0, and I think a lot of people will have seen the volley that Iñaki Williams scored. He was supplied by Nico Williams, then he supplied Nico Williams for a goal. And Gorka Guruceta got the third in what ended up being a 4-0 aggregate victory over Atletico Madrid. And they really just thumped Atleti. They were all over them. They were hounding them. They were hassling. They were harrying. It was a very impressive performance, it has to be said. And it feels like that will be remembered as the Williams game if and when Nico Williams departs, because the two of them were just rampant. Atleti had no answer for them at all. Provided, of course, they don't do something similar in the final. But yeah, it felt like Atletico were very much mauled by this Basque side. And Ernesto Valverde, I think, getting the flowers that he deserves for a fantastic job he's done. And Guruceta, I mentioned there, probably not too well known to most of most listeners or most people in European football. But yeah, he was at Athletic when he was younger. He went to kind of the second division and did reasonably well. Vimorabieta came in 2 seasons ago and looked okay. He was fine, but he wasn't necessarily a huge upgrade. And where Valverde really deserves the credit is that he stuck with Guruceta up front. He made him essentially said he was our nine. He's going to play there. We're going to stick with him. Sunset in behind him, the Williams brothers either side of him, and that's where you're getting kind of the best season of Iñaki Williams, I think, that we've seen. Sunset continues to grow, Nico Williams continues to add more things to his game, and I think that a lot of credit has to go to Valverde for having that patience with Guruceta, where many managers might not have done so when he wasn't scoring. And yeah, Atleti, I think we'll probably touch on them more in coming weeks, because they've obviously got a huge Champions League tie on the horizon, but yeah, just that away from home form continues to really humble and cause hassle for them, cause problems for them. But yeah, that lack of balance, that lack of a ball winner in midfield, which Diego Simeone has been asking for, has really come back to bite them on various occasions this season. And just, yeah, finally on them, it feels like they timed it wrong. It feels like they had a year of really impressive, balanced, very good football, a year of probably the best year of Antoine Griezmann's form that we've seen. And it just happened to coincide from about January to January, a calendar year, as opposed to a league year. And that it's kind of a dying shame. It's pretty unfortunate for Cholo.
Lovely. And meanwhile, you were also at Las Palmas' 3-3 draw with Getafe, not out in Gran Canaria, but in Madrid, and two teams on the fringes of the European race, and two teams who have surprised many this season. What did you see beyond lots of goals, rain, wind, and sleet?
Yes, I'll stop talking about the weather there. But yeah, it was just a few kind of quick notes on this. I mean, Getafe, we've spoken, I feel like, ad nauseum about Bordalas and over the last kind of 3-4 years, because he's a manager, I think, that I find him fascinating beyond kind of the personality that he has, and also kind of some of the things that he said about Greenwood this year, and Greenwood and Borja Mayoral have kind of defined this Getafe team, where I feel like they're more offensive than in Bordalas's first spell. And it's important to remember that when we started this podcast, they'd finished fifth, I think, in the season before, and they were in the Europa League knocking out Ajax. They really were at the peak of their powers, and it feels like they've almost got a more talented side this year, but with that has come kind of less balance, and the fact that he tends to leave Greenwood up out on the wing without doing too much defending means that you lose kind of that ability to press quite as much, for not necessarily for 90 minutes, because no side can, but
to kind of, yeah, put teams in a chokehold and really kind of just destroy the game. They were 3-1 up during this game, and really should have put the game to bed, but just didn't have enough in midfield to kind of shut Las Palmas down. And in part, that's credit to Las Palmas side that, as we've noted on various occasions, have been very impressive, and it's their defence that has stood out statistically. But in terms of what you see on the pitch, it's just the way they move the ball is so impressive and so calm. And Mika Marmol is very much he gets a lot of comparisons to Eric Garcia because he's small and because he's obscenely good on the ball. And his season has just been fantastic, but the control that he has of the ball and kind of the way that he manages to weight his passes to midfielders, it does make a huge difference when your midfielder only has to take one touch to move that ball on, whereas taking kind of one or two touches and having to go backwards. And you see this a lot with teams kind of building out the back, that they struggle to make that first kind of line break. And Marmol is an expert doing that. Quick shout out for Jose Campaña too, who some listeners may remember, I think a couple of years back, he was the first Levante player to get called up for Spain in, I want to say, 61 years. But yeah, he was kind of out the game until January. He'd been released by Levante, he'd been struck down by injury problems in Segunda, and yeah, really just not having a good time of it. But he's come back in, and already just 2-3 games back in, the kind of weight that he can put on his passes as well, in behind, kind of curling things in, outside of the boot kind of stuff, it really goes to show you that, like, some players will need kind of a full preseason to be at their best, and some players, they just come in and they have that technical ability to just move a game. And he came on for Las Palmas and really made a difference for them making that comeback. So yeah, just a couple of quick points of interest basically on that game. And yeah, shout out to Las Palmas, who are, I think, when you have a really good kind of final third, as Getafe do have in Borja Mayoral, Greenwoods, Jaime Mata, they've got goal scorers. Las Palmas don't, and so they focus a lot of their game on midfield and keeping control of the ball. And the way that they continue to just move it, I mean, every time they got a free kick in their own half, took maybe 2-3 seconds to take that free kick, just move the ball. And even if it was going nowhere, they just kept Getafe moving side to side, back and forth. And yeah, was it kind of always going kind of vertical? And I think the same way that some teams do these days, and it's possession based, but it's very vertical and direct. No, but I think when you don't have that firepower at the other end, it's a very smart way of going about it. So credit to Garcia Pimienta and both of these coaches, because yeah, very interesting clash.
Absolutely. And yeah, what a game to be a part of and to be in the stands for. Well, yeah, I think that's it for you and I today, Barlow, but lovely catching up with you, and thanks for giving your time. And it's great hearing from the boys at the start as well. Are you doing anything this evening?
This evening, no, just back to work, essentially. Back to work, and then I will hopefully be sat down with my dinner just in time for Real Sociedad to take on PSG, and hopefully give their season something to really shout about. What about yourself, Michael?
I'm going for my dad's birthday meal, actually. It's his 55th today, so happy birthday, Dad. You don't get many shout-outs on this podcast, but yeah, hopefully can catch a bit of last year buy-in as well.
Excellent stuff. Well, on that note, we will wrap things up. My thanks to Ali, to Albert, to yourself, Michael. And yeah, we will be back in 2 weeks' time as ever.